From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Something like major combat is underway again in Iraq. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, commander of U.S. forces there, spoke of a turning point in what he called the war. The New York Times cited aides to Sanchez who said the choice of the word war was, quote, part of a conscious effort by senior military officers to inject realism into debates in Washington. Meanwhile, hostility between the military and the media in Iraq is also mounting, with increasing incidents of verbal and physical abuse, detentions, and confiscation of equipment. On Wednesday, the president of the Associated Press Managing Editors sent Pentagon officers a protest letter urging them to, quote, immediately take steps to end such confrontations. NPR's Deborah Amos has recently returned from Iraq, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
When you heard about how the Coalition Provisional Authority officials tried to block NBC's Jim Mikliszewski from filming the October 26th attack on the Al Rashid Hotel, where Deputy Secretary Paul Wolfowitz was staying, were you surprised?
Not at all. A day later, there was a bombing on the Red Cross headquarters and four police stations. And that afternoon, we always have a briefing every day, whether it's on the record or off the record. There's an official that's made available to reporters just about every day. And when reporters wanted to know in each individual police station how many died, we were told that that was too morbid a question. And we weren't given those details. It took a while to ferret them out. I mean, the thing about Iraq is you can always find out. But it was interesting to watch them try to put a positive spin on a horrible day.
With regard to that attack on the Al Rashid Hotel, how did the coalition authorities try to explain it to the press?
They went out of their way to tell us that it was no big deal. Militarily, that may be true. One lieutenant colonel lost his life in that hotel and there were injuries. But, I mean, think about it. This was an attack on the symbol of American power in Baghdad, and they almost hit one of the architects of the war in Baghdad. The military briefers that day said, well, it was just a science project carried out in a garage. And we all said later, that's hard to know whether that's the good news or the bad news, that if anybody in Baghdad can build a Katyusha rocket launcher in their garage, then the American military is in a bit of trouble. Now, they also told us that this was absolutely, it had nothing to do with Paul Wolfowitz staying in the hotel. Except earlier in the day, there was an attack on a Black Hawk helicopter, and that happened in the town of Tikrit, a place that Paul Wolfowitz had been in that day. So the message was, we know where you are. Those rockets at the Al Rashid Hotel walked up the building and landed the last ones just a few rooms down from where he was staying.
That's quite a coincidence.
It is in those officials' blood. It is their job to put the best face on a bad situation, and every once in a while you just can't do it anymore.
Tell me how it works operationally on the ground. How do U.S. authorities try to control what you write?
For example, when I first went there in May and June, you can go just about anywhere and talk to just about anybody. Now that's a little harder. You can't go to hospitals without permission from the civilian authorities there. You can get around it. You find an Iraqi guard. You make a plea. You can get in. But officially, you're not allowed into the hospitals and you're not allowed into the morgues. It used to be that you could go to any Iraqi police station and interview the chief of police at that station. You can't do that anymore without direct permission from the CPA. There is a different atmosphere now about particular information. And those briefings that I told you about that we get maybe four or five times a week, they always open with some chiding. I saw some of you yesterday wrote that we're having a guerrilla war here. I'd like to say that this is not a guerrilla war. So, you know, every day we get a report card on what we said the day before, and we all are aware of what that can mean. I cannot tell you that there are reporters that are blackballed for any kind of negative writing, but I know that every day they are reading and listening to what we're putting out, and, you know, somebody gets a scolding.
The president has famously said that he doesn't read the papers, that he gets all the information he needs from his advisors. How does that information flow work? Is he getting all the information that he needs?
I can tell you a particular example of an economist working in the CPA, which is the provisional authority in Baghdad. And he said that it was almost impossible to pass bad news up. If he was asked to write a report, his supervisor would edit that report before it went up the chain, that the idea of the good news story is not just one that the administration is pushing on journalists, it's also an internal idea. And I think that that is a little bit more dangerous. If you can't tell your supervisor, if you've been asked to write a report about a particular subject, if he won't pass it on, that, in fact, is not good news for people who are trying to get an accurate picture and rebuild the country. Now, the internet changes things a little bit because what he said he did is he just started emailing it around Washington because he also felt that this was a very, very bad trend.
And with this week's admission that the war is still going on and not just a mop-up operation, how do you think that'll change reporting conditions?
I don't think it will change reporting conditions in any significant way. I think that General Sanchez's use of the word reality, it will add reality to the discussions in Washington, is the most important thing he said. I think that it is now time back in Washington for a dose of reality, to look seriously at who the opposition is. Even Sanchez said that we've arrested 20 that we thought were al-Qaeda, but we can't prove it. They don't have cards in their pockets. That so much of this opposition is from Iraq.
Okay. NPR's Deborah Amos has recently returned from reporting in Baghdad, and she'll be going back in a couple of months.
This month in the UK, Guillo Pontecorvo's 1966 film The Battle of Algiers came out on DVD. Here, it's still pretty hard to find, though Pentagon officials were invited to a special in-house screening a few months ago. The movie depicts, with stunning verisimilitude, how in the late 50s, French paratroopers dismantled the Algerian National Liberation Front, or FLN. As the battle proceeds on the ground in Iraq, Pontecorvo's classic rendering of war between occupiers and insurgents has been seen increasingly as an instructional film about how to fight and win by any means necessary. Bruce Hoffman, a terrorism analyst for the RAND Corporation, has used the Battle of Algiers in courses he's taught to graduate students, and he recommends it to soldiers and spies.
Well, I think the key to understanding the film is that, like all good films, it's about a search. And in this case, it's the search for intelligence, for information that the authorities need to uproot the terrorist infrastructure in Algiers during the 1950s. The Italian director, Guillo Pontecorvo, displayed a cast of characters which both did egregious things. You have, on the one hand, scenes of the terrorists planting bombs in cafeterias frequented by high school and university students. On the other hand, you have the French paratroops using perhaps the most heinous methods of torture to extract information. And what it underscores is that countering terrorism is first and foremost an intelligence game, and that the primacy of intelligence is paramount.
Pontecorvo was sympathetic with the FLN, and it would be easy to see the movie as a kind of agitprop. But it's also, from the opposite side of the question, a pretty good study of the ends justifying the means, isn't it?
Well, it's more morally ambiguous than that, because, of course, it does depict how the French paras used torture, got information, and destroyed the terrorist infrastructure in the city of Algiers. But also, the point of the film is that the French may have won the battle, but in the end, they lost the war. And in fact, it was their resort to torture and resort to these heinous methods that, in fact, drove most of the population into the terrorists' arms and almost polarized the entire conflict in a way that ensured that the French could not succeed. Not only did the local population turn against their colonial masters, but I think equally as importantly, the population in metropolitan France, not just the intellectuals in Paris, but certainly much of the population was repelled and recoiled at really the harsh methods that had to be employed to win the struggle.
I think you mentioned in your piece that the Battle of Algiers has actually been used as a kind of instructional video, both by terrorist groups and counterterrorist organizations. How has it worked that way?
For terrorist organizations, I think it's been an enormously useful means to develop their tradecraft, in other words, their counterintelligence capabilities, to avoid being caught, to give them insight into how the government security forces operate. And we know, for example, that the IRA has viewed it, that the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka have studied it. Supposedly the Black Panthers in the United States in the 1960s also studied it. At the same time, many military and security services have also watched it. I think what one of the most, to me, interesting scenes in the film is when Colonel Mathieu depicts this, what has been described as an organogram, that is this on the blackboard, a sort of pyramid structure with little pyramids within it that indicate the terrorist cells that lead up and narrow down to the mastermind orchestrating the terrorist operation. And I think for security forces, it's enormously useful to see that's a very timeless message that almost all successful terrorist groups operate on a cellular basis, and that the key is finding the nodes and the connections between the cells and then gradually, systematically, relentlessly bearing down on the head of the organization, and that's what the film is about.
Pontecorvo's film was so detailed and of such verisimilitude that he actually had to have a disclaimer in the beginning saying that there's no documentary footage. How did he get such accuracy?
It was, firstly, a joint Algerian and Italian production. So in that sense, he had access and did the shooting in Algiers, in the Kasbah, in exactly the same locations where this battle was fought. Also, and I think fascinatingly, many of the real-life protagonists, many of the terrorists from the 1950s, reprised their roles on screen. Pontecorvo himself led a partisan brigade in Italy, in Milan, in fact, during World War II. So as a guerrilla fighter himself, he knew exactly what he was talking about. And that, I think, is a key element. You're talking about someone who actually had experience in urban warfare and in street fighting.
Pauline Kael regarded Battle of Algiers as one of the great anti-war films. Is it an anti-war movie?
I think what it shows really is just how brutal and how dirty fighting terrorism can become, and indeed how dirty and how brutal, undeniably, terrorism is in itself. Here you have a democracy, the French Republic, who willy-nilly almost slides into the use of these very base and repugnant means. So I think the point of studying this is that eventually any society is confronted with these types of dilemmas. And I think my argument is that it's better to at least take a forward-looking view and begin to consider them and debate them rather than find yourselves boxed into a corner and then adopting things that may prove counterproductive in the long run.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bruce Hoffman is a policy analyst for the RAND Corporation.
Up next, why the royals have their knickers in a twist and theater ripped from the transcripts in Britain.
This is On the Media from NPR. We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ah, the British monarchy. The latest royal scandal swirls around Prince Charles, rumored to have been involved in a sexual incident with a male aide. Britain's strict libel laws have barred coverage of the rumor, but the prince has issued a denial anyway. Meanwhile, charges of censorship are being levied by the European press because the British distributors are preventing the delivery of such papers as France's Le Monde and Le Figaro, Italy's La Stampa, and Spain's El País. Also, court action is underway, all of which has left the British news consumer in a more or less constant state of titillation this week over, well, they don't know exactly what. David Hooper is a solicitor specializing in libel law, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much indeed.
So what exactly is preventing the British press from reporting the details?
Well, this is prior restraint, and you would be in contempt of court and your newspaper could be fined. You could even be sent to prison if you deliberately flouted an order of a court. They're saying you must not repeat the substance of these allegations. And everyone's mind is rather boggling as to what on earth allegedly went on.
Meanwhile, the European papers have been reporting freely on the scandal, and they've had their distribution in England cut off, at least for a day. 7,000 copies of Le Monde were said to be pulped. Was there a court order against them, or were the distributors in England simply afraid of the possibility of being prosecuted?
I think they'd have been afraid of a possibility, and I think they feel that they need to act responsibly. But there's a long history of this in the UK, going back to 1936, when our then Prince of Wales was having an affair with the American Mrs. Simpson, and you were allowed to read about that in Europe, but you certainly weren't allowed even a whisper of it in the English press.
And so Le Monde is crying censorship, and an Italian publishers group said the ban was undemocratic. Those big issues aside, it's awfully difficult to put this particular toothpaste back in the tube, isn't it? I mean, the details are widely available on the internet.
I think that's right, but people do distinguish between what appears in the equivalent of the New York Times and the more harebrained stuff that appears on the internet. I mean, there may well have been a justification for the injunction in the first place because it's private and it may very well not be true. I mean, the evidence seems to suggest it is not true. But you have to look at it as the situation changes. And eventually, I think the English courts will probably have to lift the injunction or modify it because they will say it has become ridiculous.
Are injunctions lifted when they become ridiculous?
That's what happened in a case that I was involved in concerning the former MI5 agent Peter Wright, who gave descriptions which were then considered highly secret of alleged misconduct by our secret service, MI5. You could buy the book at JFK and people were taking suitcasefuls of them back to the UK. And when the judges said that millions of Americans know, everyone on the continent knows, millions of British know because they bought the books at JFK, everyone in Ireland knows, they said it's becoming ridiculous, even though it may have been justified in the first place.
With the internet and the ease of acquiring information from anywhere at any time around the world, do you think that Britons will begin to question some of these arcane press freedom laws?
I think inevitably they will, but some degree of privacy has got to be protected. We may all argue as to where the dividing line is. The problem is, if you take no action at all, then people feel that they can publish anything they like about you. And the fact that you can't be 100% effective may not necessarily be an argument, you know, for not acting against the 80% where you can be effective. And of course, the newspapers in England slightly want it both ways, in that they are not above taunting people, saying, well, if it was untrue, why didn't you sue? So in a sense, they sometimes do make a rod for their own back.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David Hooper is a solicitor specializing in libel law. This summer in London, a courtroom inquiry had aspiring spectators lining up around the block. The Hutton inquiry investigated the circumstances around the suicide of a government scientist, David Kelly. Kelly killed himself after having been fingered as a source for the BBC's accusation that the government sexed up an intelligence dossier on Iraqi weapons to make a stronger case for war. Now, Londoners are lining up for a ticket to the staged version of the proceedings, which ends with the moving testimony of Kelly's widow.
Well, we had a meal. He seemed a little bit reluctant to come and watch the news. The main story was that a source had identified itself. Immediately, David said to me, "It's me."
The story, we've seen a press statement that was put out by the Ministry of Defence on the 8th of July. Was that the story that was on the television?
That's right.
How did he seem to you?
Desperately unhappy about it. Really, really unhappy about it. Totally dismayed. He mentioned he'd had a reprimand at that stage from the MOD, but they'd not been unsupportive, were his words.
The production has been mounted by the Tricycle Theatre in North London, one of what director Nicholas Kent calls the tribunal plays, all ripped and condensed from actual courtroom transcripts.
It had a lot of government ministers, including John Major and Margaret Thatcher, who gave evidence to that inquiry, but television and radio wasn't allowed in. And most recently, we did the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, which was about a black man in London who was murdered by five racists, and they were never apprehended by the police. And that particular inquiry had huge resonances on the way we're policed in this country and upon institutional racism.
When you put on these plays, do you go beyond the transcripts, the available texts?
No, we go just to the transcripts. We try and be as fair as possible to all parties. We do it almost like a public service. We try and give everyone a fair say, so that we give the government a fair say, and those who question the government and the BBC, and obviously Dr. Kelly's family in this particular instance.
How does the creative process work in here, beyond the acting? Do you take things out of sequence? How do you edit?
No, we put things into sequence and keep them in sequence, but we edit obviously fairly severely because there's 5 weeks' worth of hearings, and we've boiled it down to 2.5 hours of stage time. And that seems to give people a very satisfying evening in the theatre, because these are issues they've wrestled with when they've read them in the newspapers on a daily basis. And this way they can get an overview of the inquiry.
But they're not plays in a traditional sense. You may have a beginning, middle, and an end, but you don't have the climax and the denouement. They're satisfying as theatre because people want to see what they can only read if they go through the trouble of getting the transcripts.
That's partly it, but they enjoy the cut and thrust of people being interrogated. And they do have a beginning, a middle, end, and they have a very strong form. And there is a catharsis. For instance, we have in the end 17 minutes of Dr. Kelly's widow's evidence. And that's incredibly moving. It makes people cry. And it's especially moving when it's set against, in the first act, the government apparatchiks talking about how they outed him, so to speak.
From your previous productions of transcripts on stage, what mistakes have you now learned to avoid?
In the very first one, The Arms to Iraq, we had Mrs. Thatcher, and we had an actress play Mrs. Thatcher, obviously, and it became a little bit of a turn. She did it immensely well, and people wanted to see Mrs. Thatcher. And to some extent, that maybe took away from the seriousness of the whole issue. So that in the Hutton inquiry, we haven't used Tony Blair, because I think the Hutton inquiry is very much about the culture of Tony Blair's government, not about Tony Blair himself. And the culture of that government has a lot to do with spin.
We read that when Geoffrey Robertson, Queen's Counsel, petitioned to have the Hutton inquiry into Dr. Kelly's death televised, he warned the court that there was, quote, a small theatre in North London that would probably make the matter public anyway. But you do think that it would be a far better service to the British people if these hearings were televised?
I think it would be a very good service. I think you have a very good situation in the States where you do televise your Senate committee hearings like Watergate. We have only just got round to televising Parliament.
And we lament over here that we don't have the equivalent of Parliament's question time, when MPs can take the Prime Minister to task on specific issues. Our president never really has to face the Congress in a public free-for-all.
No, I think question time is very good. It does make the Prime Minister just one normal mortal MP for about half an hour, and he has to account for anything, and he doesn't know what the questions are that he's going to have to field. Public inquiries also exert that wonderful democratic role. I mean, here we are with the Hutton inquiry. We're seeing documents that are 3 weeks old. We're not allowed to see documents for 30 years normally. 9,000 documents we've now seen, some of them saying top secret. And surprise, surprise, there hasn't been a revolution in this country and the government hasn't fallen.
So I guess my last question is, you have these extraordinarily popular productions. Are you looking forward to the day when these hearings are all televised and this line of theatrical enterprise is closed forever for you?
I really am looking forward to that day. I think it's very necessary for the democratic process. However, obviously, it's interesting to do it, and I'll miss them, but there'll be some other theatre challenges coming along, I'm quite certain.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nicholas Kent is the director of the Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn, North London. ¶¶
Michael Eisner, Rupert Murdoch, Sumner Redstone, Barry Diller, Martha Stewart, these are the media titans of our age, or as Michael Wolff calls them, moguls. Wolff, in his New York Magazine column, variously chronicles the exploits, assassinates the character, and ruminates on the larger meaning of these larger-than-life figures that he theorizes are presiding over the self-destruction of big media. His new book, Autumn of the Moguls, nominally follows the progress of a Wall Street media conference, but is mainly just a pretext for Wolff to hold forth on the titans he simultaneously envies and loathes. Michael Wolff joins us now. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. That's the best summary I have heard of this book so far.
Thank you. Keep flattering me, and this could go very, very well. So tell me, why do you think that big media are doomed?
Well, I think by all the conventional measures, it seems quite clear that there's a big problem here. There's a problem for investors. None of these companies have kept pace over 20 years with the S&P 500. For each of the core businesses of these companies, be it magazines, television, books, radio, you name it, each of these businesses is weaker now than it was 10 years ago or 10 years before that. Combined with the fact that you have massive audience flight in every realm of this business, you literally cannot hold on to your customer base. I'd say that that's the baseline for this doomsday scenario.
I guess the poster children for your theory would be Jean-Marie Messier, formerly of Vivendi, and Jerry Levin, formerly of AOL Time Warner.
They will do as poster children, yes.
But you seem to have more regard for Barry Diller, one, and also, surprisingly, for Rupert Murdoch, whom you, if I recall correctly, hitherto had pretty much routinely excoriated in your column, portrayed it as a sort of antichrist. But it seems that you're coming around to a different way of thinking.
You know, I'm not sure I've come around to a different way of thinking other than the fact that I have met Murdoch and I like him personally. I think he's smart. I think he's open. He shares my interests, which is the media business. So he's fun to talk to. Having said that, I think that his company is as doomed as any others, if for no other reason that Rupert is 72 and certainly can't last forever. I mean, one of the interesting things about Rupert is that you can literally blame the state of the media business on him. The media business, as it is now construed, in which companies own every part of the media business, is a Murdoch idea. And really, when he started this, and he may have started it with a certain kind of logic, he was followed by everyone else with absolutely no logic other than the fact that they were desperately frightened that he knew something they didn't know.
We on this program have often wrung our hands and beat our chests about media consolidation as an affront to democracy and a danger to democracy. But to read your book, I guess I should conclude that I needn't worry about consolidation because the marketplace will take care of the problem, that these gigantic structures will simply eventually collapse of their own weight.
I think it's true. You don't have to worry about it, at least looking forward a few years from now. And it all, although it is an affront to democracy, it's also, interestingly enough, an affront to business. It just doesn't work.
Well, let's say these gigantic corporations do eventually or rapidly disintegrate. If the media business follows the path of other industries, that means there should be one Uber player who's there to gobble up the pieces for pennies on a dollar and survive and prosper in the ashes of its former competitors.
Right.
Who do you suppose will be the last colossus standing?
It's noteworthy that GE has just gobbled up Vivendi. Vivendi auctioned itself off, and GE bought it for, practically speaking, nothing. Suddenly, there was that moment where everybody said, oh, my God, so that's the value of a diversified media company, zero. And so I think you're right that this is going to happen, and it will be, I don't know, it may be GE. Comcast is probably a likely ultimate consolidator. they will very shortly dominate television distribution. But I think one of the processes that happens here is it's not one person, but it's a kind of everything falls in on itself. So I would say Comcast is part of the surviving entity, and add to that somebody who has financing ability, and you'll have the final media conglomerate.
You describe Jean-Marie Messier, the disgraced architect of Vivendi, as a fool. You characterize Jerry Levin, of formerly of AOL Time Warner, as having behaved stupidly. You call Sumner Redstone of Viacom a major pompous ass. You say yourself in your book that you're a proximity crackhead, yet having attained proximity to the moguls, you seem not to be able to help yourself from attacking them. Was there any of them who, having gotten to know you, have some grudging respect for, who you believe may be the very genius and visionary that he represents himself to be?
Well, as I said before, I think the problems with being a genius and visionary is that you will invariably become the opposite of that. But right now, the genius and visionary of the media business, precisely because he has gotten out of the media business, is Barry Diller. Absolutely no question. He's the guy on whose shoulders none of this disaster will fall. He's effectively brushed this aside, washed his hands of this, and has taken his money and run.
Unlike almost everyone else you write about, he bought low and sold high.
Exactly.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much.
New York Magazine columnist Michael Wolff is author of Autumn of the Moguls, My Misadventures with the Titans, Poseurs, and Money Guys Who Mastered and Messed Up Big Media.
Coming up, a cartoonist's take on politics and war, and a disloyal OTM reporter gives away our radio secrets.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters about last week's show, which focused on media and democracy. When we discussed the Fairness Doctrine, a rule that once applied to broadcast but never to print, Thomas Wright of Oak Park, Illinois, says we ignored the most important issue. Quote, "Unlike newspapers, there is a physical limit to the number of radio channels. It would certainly be infringing on the right of the press if each of the four corners of every intersection in the city was licensed to one newspaper, with no others allowed. Since the broadcast by one radio station crowds out any nearby frequencies, use of the bandwidth is exploitation of a shared resource by one commercial entity. Perhaps it should be viewed more like national parkland."
Several listeners took umbrage at my characterization of C-SPAN. Listener Keith Brewer sums it up with this: "It was a great program except for your referring to C-SPAN as basically a yawn. You mislead listeners who don't watch it into thinking it is little more than a camera on the House and Senate. Come on, don't you watch book TV on the weekends or the great weekly series on the presidents and also on American authors? This is the most informative station on TV, and you utterly failed to point this out to unknowing listeners who probably will never try it. But he loved our song about the FCC.
As a matter of fact, the song drew a good-natured response. However, Douglas Steen of Denver, Colorado wrote, "I'm a big fan of On the Media, and I was particularly interested in your story about the Fairness Doctrine. I'd be interested in hearing more about the effects of media deregulation in the 80s and 90s and about the effects of current regulations. Isn't there, for example, some kind of government regulation that requires radio news programs to air a warning to sensitive listeners before the hosts break into song?"
And listener Bonnie Hill spoke for several when she requested plaintively, "Please don't sing anymore." Well, not for a while, anyway. Keep those reviews coming, though, to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Joe Sacco is a journalist, a cartoonist, and a cartoon journalist, drawing himself into his books and strips as a kind of bespectacled everyman. He literally illustrates the difficulties involved in reporting from war zones around the world. In his book about the Bosnian War, set in the annexed and embattled town of Garajda, he's embarrassed that he can come and go while his new friends remain in danger. In the Palestinian refugee camps, he sheepishly eats while his hosts describe their experiences in the Israeli detention centers. Now he's on a new and very different beat, a comic strip campaign diary for the Washington Monthly called Meanwhile in America. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Are you going to be a boy on the bus for the campaign diary? Are you going to wait for the story to come
to
you?
No. I mean, the idea is not to follow the campaign around or even pay particular attention to the details of what a candidate is saying. I don't want to just have sort of a diatribe about politics, but I want to show it in the context of real life. And in real life, you sit on the toilet. In real life, you're having an argument over a meal. In real life, you're washing the dishes.
So how would you compare covering the American political campaign with, for example, covering a genocidal siege on a supposedly protected city or in Palestinian camps where people are living in very difficult conditions?
Well, the books I did about the Palestinians and about the Bosnians are more journalistic. I mean, I went there, I did my interviews, I came back and I wrote and drew the books, and it's about their stories. The Washington Strip pieces are a little more polemical. They're journalistic only in the sense in that I try to be accurate about the people I'm talking to and the conversations I'm having, but I think my opinion is creeping into them more.
Well, your other work is certainly not without a point of view. Would you regard yourself as an objective journalist?
No, I wouldn't regard myself as an objective journalist, not at all. I mean, I think what I'm trying to do with my work about the Palestinians and the Bosnians is present my point of view, but let the facts speak for themselves. In the case of the Washington Monthly strip, I'm not afraid to outright express my opinions, no holds barred. I don't like the Bush administration. I have no problem saying that.
Well, I guess when you're working from a point of view, cartooning puts you at a tremendous advantage because while you're drawing what you're seeing, the way in which you draw what you're seeing can very much color the reader's perception of the events, no?
No, I think that's true. I mean, you can write something very objectively, as you had put it before, but then the drawing can be a counterpoint to that somehow. Journalists write very dispassionately about horrible events. And that sort of thing is lost often when you're reading it. The journalists sort of pride themselves on being dispassionate. But I can inject the passion of what goes on into the drawings, I think.
If you went about your business a different way and tried to take point of view out of it, would that even be possible? Aren't you almost by definition as a cartoonist a subjective journalist?
No, not necessarily, I think. I mean, I think there are ways I could draw something so it would be considered objective. The way I could do that is to draw myself out of the comics. If I was just to draw what I'm seeing as if I was a camera, I think that would be considered more objective. But I place myself in my comics partially to tip the reader off, to let the reader know that they're seeing everything through my eyes, that this is one person's viewpoint. You know, when I go to a place like Gaza, I'm a Westerner going into Gaza. I want the reader to know that. You know, I think it's something that most journalists don't really let the reader know, that they are not from that place. They're not so smart that they understand everything, that they can report something objectively. I've got my prejudices, and I tend to wear them on my cuff in my work. But I think that's valuable for the reader to know.
Well, Joe, thank you very much.
Well, I enjoy talking to you.
Joe Sacco is a journalist, a cartoonist, a columnist for The Washington Monthly, and author of The Fixer, the story of a Serb loyal to the Bosnian government during the siege of Sarajevo.
In the aftermath of the Jason Blair scandal, the New York Times ran a 7,600-word postmortem, which provided readers with a rare look at its newsroom practices. The Times is not the only news organization of late to give the public a fuller view of how the journalistic sausage is made. In a similar spirit of transparency, one of our reporters, John Solomon, who is new to radio, suggested that there were aspects of the production process here at On the Media that might interest our listeners. In fact, he thought that some of these methods, used not just by NPR but throughout public radio, would come as much of a surprise to them as they did to him. A warning, those who prefer not to peek behind the curtain should turn down the volume for the next 10 minutes.
Before I started working at On the Media, I was an avid NPR news listener. To me, like many devotees, an important aspect of the network's appeal is how smooth, well-crafted, and polished it sounds. Everyone seems so eloquent. Interviewers ready with a clearly posed, on-point question. Interviewees offering an articulate answer. Rarely an or you know uttered. Correspondents in the field, even when reporting from the middle of the rainforest, are equally cogent and coherent, and hosts move naturally, effortlessly, and spontaneously between stories. That soothing and reliable sound has made the NPR product distinctive from other radio and news media.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Next, the rule of law in Russia.
Tips for senators on how to survive.
Now that I am on the other side of the speaker, it has been fascinating to discover the importance of behind-the-scenes technical packaging in bringing about that effect. Of course, I want to make it clear that I have found the NPR News on-air staff, present company excluded, is indeed smooth and eloquent and normally ask the right question. But they, and now me, aren't as perfect as it once seemed. New York Times media reporter David Carr.
Everybody always sounds erudite and witty on NPR, and I've always wondered why, and I think there probably is some darkroom magic going on there.
My exposure to the darkroom began when I edited my first story. I sat at the digital editing console with a producer listening to an interview with a source I had recorded earlier. With just strokes of the keyboard, he cleaned up and tightened the sound bites I was going to use, taking out sentences, words, and even some of the pauses, making what are called internal edits. Then the various thoughts were woven together technically in a way that would be totally hidden to the listener. In fact, the public is far less aware of editing on radio than on television or in print. For example, to eliminate words, a TV producer has to use more visible means, such as a cutaway shot or jump cut. Newspaper reporters, by form, must put a break between non-consecutive quotations, among other constraints. David Carr says that at the Times,
people have to speak in complete sentences or you don't use it.
NPR interview subjects almost never complain about the slicing and dicing, in large part because the edits make them sound more articulate without changing the meaning. In fact, what David Carr actually said on tape was,
people have to speak in complete sentences or you don't use it.
While many public radio programs, particularly call-in shows, are live, I was surprised to find out that newsmaker interviews for the daily NPR national news shows, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, are often not. Usually they are pre-taped and quickly edited down. Likewise, I was stunned when I learned that the main Fresh Air interview is actually condensed from a longer Q&A. And at times, the Car Talk guys will edit in some extra laughs kept on file.
They will do that, I hear.
Here at On the Media, we do even more editing because as a weekly show, we have more time. It helps make us sound far more articulate than we actually are. For example, here's Bob's original question in a recent interview taping with National Journal's Bill Powers.
Now, your column this week says that there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. That is a very serious charge, really, against the media. How true is it? Are the motives really so? Are the motives really so sinister? That's not quite the right word. Are they really so?
You want to say, are they really so vicious?
Mindlessly bloodthirsty. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
Here's how it sounded after the editing.
Now, your column this week says there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
Further underscoring the invisibility of radio techniques was the answer to a question I asked when I first started at On the Media. Where's Bob? It turns out that OTM's co-host does most of his interviewing and hosting from his home in Virginia, while the rest of us are in the New York City headquarters. That distance could be why I picked one of his mistakes to highlight the editing process. Nothing is so identified with NPR News as its signature field pieces, and nothing is more of a cut-and-paste production collage. My first such story was a media workout day held for reporters by the National Football League's New York Jets at their practice facility. Before I left, a producer suggested I record ambient sound during the drills that could be mixed later into the piece underneath my narration. That confused me. As a listener, I had thought that the narration in field pieces was recorded by the reporter at the location.
Oh no!
I guess I should have realized reporters wouldn't always be able to deliver their clear, concise, well-organized prose while also reporting the story. Okay, now that the curtain has been pulled back a bit, the natural question is, so what? Is there any problem that this behind-the-scenes manufacturing process is largely unknown, maybe until now, to the average NPR listener?
I think there's no question that most people listening to NPR programs are unaware of the artifice that's there.
NPR veteran field reporter Alex Chadwick is now the host of the program Day to Day.
Well, why do they try to make it sound that way if it's not that way? It's not real. Well, because the world of presentation and the media really isn't real in that sense. It is real, but it's a kind of a heightened reality. It's a better reality. It's a cleaner and more articulate reality.
By making everyone sound better and increasing the amount of content in the broadcasts, it would seem to be a win-win-win for the network, its sources, and most importantly, its listeners. Yet is there a small sin of omission? NPR may not be actively misleading listeners. But we all know that they don't know how we create the cleaner and more articulate reality. That post-production perfection may be why some sources at the end of a taped interview are apologetic about their perceived lack of perfection, like recent OTM guest Harper's editor Lewis Lapham.
Lewis, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Brooke, to get it all mixed up, but I mean, you'll be able to cut something out of it, right?
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
Ironically, television is usually seen as the news medium with artifice, while radio is viewed as more authentic. NPR's ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin believes trust in television news has declined in part because viewers see it as overproduced entertainment. Is it possible that the fact listeners are unaware of how much production is involved has helped retain their trust in NPR news? NPR's executive producer for training, Jonathan Kern, is overseeing a year-long project on news standards, which will likely result in the network providing listeners with more information on production techniques. But he doesn't see much utility for the public in adding transparency for transparency's sake.
Do they really want to know how we edited every actuality and whether there were internal edits? I would say no. They probably don't want to or need to know that. Would it be a good idea occasionally to explain how it's done? Absolutely.
It also may be worth examining whether there are normal production elements that may unnecessarily deceive listeners. For example, this is how All Things Considered's Melissa Block introduced a report on President Bush's visit to Singapore last month.
NPR's Vicky O'Hara is traveling with the president and joins us now from Singapore. Vicky, the centerpiece of this trip to Asia for the president was the annual...
Kern and Dvorkin agree that the use of joins us in an introduction strongly implies that the interview is live, when in fact it may have been taped hours before.
I think it's a morally slippery slope. I think it makes more sense to say, we spoke to Vicky O'Hara a few hours ago, boom, and you take that. The idea of being live is a construct and almost a vanity of the electronic media now.
But again, has any real harm been done? Neither Kern, the former executive producer of All Things Considered, nor the producers here at OTM remember getting even one complaint from a source about how an interview was cut, which is remarkable considering how much editing is done. In fact, the most important reason to be more open about the production process may be as a vaccination in the event of such a complaint in the future. It might help avoid the massive self-flagellation that the New York Times has recently gone through.
As soon as there's the scandal that pops up where somebody's quote got cleaned up and ended up saying exactly the opposite thing of what they intended to say, well, then, of course, we'll all be on some big fatwa about audio rigor and what. But in the meantime, amongst the list of sort of journalistic mis and malfeasance, I think it's below misdemeanor and just above jaywalking. Now you make sure and clean up my quotes so they sound good, won't you?
They do it for me, David, so I'll do it for you. For On the Media, this, for John Solomon, okay, one more time. For On the Media, this is John Solomon. Does that work at the end, you think? Okay. Thanks, guys.
Well, that was a little bit embarrassing, and that's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, Marcia Caldwell, and Adam Hamill, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Nicholas and John Scheffler at WCMU-FM in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, and from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Is that all right?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.